Understood is a resource I have recommended for many years to parents looking for support with learning and thinking differences such as ADHD, dyslexia, and more. And I'm subsequently excited to tell you about their podcast, Understood Explains. This season, the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Urtube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. They cover topics such as how to tell if your child needs an IEP, common myths about special education, and the difference between IEPs and 504 plans. I love how Understood Explains breaks down the overwhelm by unpacking an important topic each season and then drilling down further into key basics in each episode. Most episodes are between 10 to 15 minutes, and episodes are available in both English and Spanish. So fantastic, right? To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of smart, compassionate guests, you will come away with insights and tactics to help you find the agency and space to simplify and declutter your home, time, mental space, and more. Hello, friends. I'm so excited about today's guest, especially since I have received a slew of requests for content related to parenting teens, including communication challenges. My guest's work is all about communication in this space. I first came to know Ellen Galinsky through her work as president of the Families and Work Institute. And in fact, something from one of her reports that I learned many years ago has stuck with me through all of my years of parenting. In one of her surveys, she asked, if you had one wish to improve how your parents' work affects your life, what would it be? The largest proportion of young kids wanted parents to be less tired or stressed. They weren't identifying things like material goods or big experiences. And interestingly, this was out of joint with what parents assumed. Only 2% of parents guessed that kids would say less stressed. Instead, 56% of parents thought kids would wish for more time. I mean, wow, that really has become an orienting anchor for me in all the years since. Ellen is the best-selling author of Mind in the Making and has a new book coming out, The Breakthrough Years, a new scientific framework for raising thriving teens. The Breakthrough Years study is an incredible distillation of work. It includes interviews with 45 leading adolescence researchers, analysis of hundreds of studies related to adolescent development. In 2019, her team conducted a quantitative study of 1,666 9 to 19-year-olds and their parents. They did qualitative interviews with 56 parents and 52 adolescents from this original group. They also did a follow-up quantitative study with 1,115 of these parents and kids in 2020 to see how people were faring, notably amidst the pandemic. And in this time period, they also conducted a behavioral study assessing executive function skills with 223 6th to 12th graders in 9 schools and 6 states. This book truly is a compendium. It is loaded with science and anecdotes and all sorts of tactics. So let's get right to our conversation. Welcome, Ellen. I'm so happy to have you on the mic today. Thank you for joining me amidst your very busy schedule.
I'm thrilled to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, knowing your time is valuable, I want to jump right in, also because I have a lot of questions. And let's start 101 with dismantling the negative narrative about teens, which is kind of one of my life side missions. Ellen, why should parents focus on the opportunity instead of the vulnerability of these years?
Oh, that's such a good question, Christine. I think that if we think about how we like to be treated, if someone sees us in a negative way, we're going to live up or live down to that expectation. We are very sensitive to the way that people think or talk about us. And so it's not something that's just particular for teenagers. It's something that's really part of all of our lives. That said, we have very enduring negative views about teenagers. I don't know about you, but almost as soon as my son was born, people were saying to me, oh, he's cute now, but just wait till he's a teenager. Mm-hmm. Did they say that to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 61% of parents heard that before their kids were teenagers in my study. And when I started, I practice a form of research called civic science. And when I started this project, I went out to young people and I asked them, what do you want to know about people your age? And what should adults know about people your age? And what do you want me to ask researchers? And overwhelmingly, before I ever did a study, I heard, don't stereotype us, don't label us. Mm-hmm. Some of us, but not all of us. Again and again and again. Some of us, but not all of us. We're not all addicted to our cell phones. The internet is not going to be the end of us. We are not the anxious generation. You know, just don't make assumptions about negative assumptions about all of us. And that actually turns out to be wise on kids' part. One of the questions that I asked was to parents was, if you had one word or phrase to describe the teen brain, what would that be? And only 14%, I don't know if you can believe that, but it was really 14% of us used positive words. Mm-hmm. Most of us, 59%, used negative words. And it mattered. What I found was, because this is a study, that we could control for the things that might affect kids' relationship with their parents or kids' feelings about themselves. We could control for their demographics statistically. We could control for the amount of conflict that a parent had with their kids, either reported by the teenager or reported by the parent. We could control for the negative words that parents used about their own child. And even with those controls, the kids whose parents used negative word about the generic teenage brain were sadder, were more depressed, were more anxious. And this was 9 months later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of staggering. In the introduction, I will have laid out the staged approach to the Breakthrough Years study. And there is something related to words, since we're talking about those first words you heard when one of your kids was born. And something you wrote really stopped me in my tracks regarding those negative descriptions you're talking about. And the quote is, perhaps because adolescents look more like adults and sometimes speak and act like adults, we seem to be judging them against an adult yardstick and find them lacking. I just hadn't heard that before. So can you share a little bit more about what you heard from families when parents shifted their behavior to use positive words to describe their teens? Because I was kind of, it was a little stunning to read it. So I would love for you to share with people.
Well, it was a little stunning for me to find it. I mean, it wasn't something, again, research is an adventure. You don't know, as you know, because you're a researcher, you don't know what you're going to find. That's why you do it. You do it to learn. You do it to get deeper, to better understand in ways that we can live better. So I took a deeper look at the actual words that parents used about their kids, and there was an immediate finding. 11% of parents used the actual word immature. And I went, whoa. And then another 8% used words like unfinished, incomplete, mush, words like that, you know, mm-hmm. that meant. What struck me was that we're thinking about teenagers, we're thinking about adolescents as deficit adults. They're not adults. They're immature. They're unfinished adults. They're mm-hmm. not experienced, inexperienced adults. And so we don't use words like a toddler is an immature preschooler. Mm-hmm. Or a baby is an immature toddler. We just don't. We understand that stage of development. But I don't think we actually understand adolescent stages of development. So what we see as deficits are actually built into our species to help us in this important stage of life. We need to explore. We need to move out. We need to try new things. And we need to have a very quick reaction because we don't know. Our parents aren't necessarily there. We don't know if we're safe or not. So we need to have we need to be like emotional detectors. We need to have a strong reaction to things that happen to us as we learn to navigate the wider world. This is what we're primed to do. Again, all species, all cultures. And so we're judging kids for doing what they actually need to do. When we shift, as you say, when we shift to, I would call it an understanding of what this stage of development is all about, then I think we talk to kids differently and we act differently. And a simple example was, one of the questions I asked was, if you had one wish to change, you know, the lives of people your age, that would improve the lives of people your age, what would that wish be? You know, from knowing my research, that it's a question that I've always asked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one young woman, you know, 16-year-old, I don't know who she is, you know, this is a survey nationally representative, wrote about the way that adults talk to her, like, oh, you know, they would say things like, you're a hormonal mess, or you'll get over it, you know, or everybody goes through this, you'll be fine, mm-hmm. without really saying, no, you feel this really strongly right now. And of course, in 5 years, it's not going to be so important. But right now, it is very important. And it's supposed to be important to you. That's how you're learning about the world. Mm-hmm. So it's like telling little kids that they shouldn't have stranger anxiety. You know, they should just get over stranger anxiety, without realizing that that's the way we learn about the world. So we'll talk to kids differently when we understand their development. And then we'll give them experiences that enable them to do what they're primed to do. We've been so focused on negative risks about the, you know, the quote, quote, dumb things that kids do when they're teenagers. You know, that's the way we joke around. But in fact, if we give them things to do that are thrilling, exciting, explorative, where they can learn about themselves and who they are, positive risks, it may be taking a new class, it may be trying out for drama. You play an instrument. It may be tackling an instrument. It may be all kinds of different things. We can give them those risks. That's, again, feeding into their development in constructive ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so wonderful. And I'm not a Pollyanna, but when I read your work, especially related to this quote or on the pages near this, where you talk about parents using those positive words and being intentional about it to describe the teen brain. And just 9 months later, I mean, one, kids are listening, they're hearing it.
Yes.
And then
yes.
they were reporting fewer negative feelings, angry, sad, afraid, worried, and being more engaged in school. So for me, that feels like such a wonderful, hopeful thing for parents to think, okay, yeah, I can change what I'm doing. I can show up in a supportive way, and my kids will hear it, even if I think they're not listening.
They are listening. In fact, some kids wrote, we see you, we hear you, mm-hmm. you may not think we're noticing, but we are. And I've heard that in all the studies that I've done. They are watching us. They are detectives. They are figuring out how the world works by watching us.
Oh, 100%. All right, Ellen, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you struggle with boundaries and the general complexities of peopling? Relationships are necessary to our well-being, and some relationships are just, well, complicated. A good chunk of the work I have done in therapy centers on relationships, how to own my part of the story, how to let go of relationships that are toxic, and how to navigate challenging relationships in a way that doesn't drain me. And all of this work helps me show up better for myself and also as a partner, mom, friend, family member, and business owner. If you're thinking of starting therapy, check out BetterHelp. This online therapy platform was designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/edit today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/edit. As you know, I value stories and the connection that the sharing of stories can bring so much. And if you're looking for a gift for Mother's Day, check out StoryWorth. StoryWorth is all about celebrating and preserving stories. Every week, StoryWorth emails a loved one of your choosing a question prompt that you pick. For example, how did you decide when to have children? And what was your mom like when you were a child? Your loved one simply responds to the email with a story of any length. You will receive copies of these emails, and after 1 year, StoryWorth compiles the stories and any photos provided into a keepsake book. Funny enough, I was just chatting with a neighbor who told me that her mom gifted copies of her StoryWorth album to immediate family members, and literally everyone was crying, in a good, loving way. I loved this example because while yes, StoryWorth is a great gift between a parent and kid, in this case, it was a gift from sister to sister that then was shared across generations. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years, StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/edit. That's storyworth.com/edit to save $10 on your first purchase. Hello, friends. We are back with the wonderful Ellen Galinsky. Ellen, let's talk about feelings. So how can parents and caregivers best support tweens and teens with emotional fluency? And maybe this is a little personal, but perhaps especially if the adult is struggling with this, having not had a model for emotional fluency as a kid. I've made a lot of progress, by the way.
That's great. You're so right. It can be hard with big feelings all over the place. Give me a break. That's the way we can feel. But I think the first thing to understand is that their feelings aren't our feelings. Mm. We are the adult, they are the child. And we don't, a friend of mine told me about how she told her parent about how her boyfriend broke up with her and her mother burst into tears. And she was like, what? I'm the one who's supposed to be upset. Now I have to take care of you. Mm. First understand that it's their own feelings. And then, listen to the extent that you can and find ways for your kids to express themselves. I found so many young people really benefiting from actual ways to express their feelings through dance, through ballet, through theater, through painting, through other ways of expressing yourself that aren't just here's how I'm feeling right at this moment, but ways of figuring out who you are and exploring your identity through art. And I think that's why studies have found that art is so important during the teenage years. We're programmed to want art in a sense. There's a wonderful book called Your Brain on Art that talks about this. And I think that it's something that we can use to help young people express themselves.
Mm, that's wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. I actually feel like my 12-year-old is certainly coming into that with theater, which is totally new for our family. I can see that happening in real time, which is really cool.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that one thing that parents struggle with, I've heard about it a lot in my years in the parenting space, is this issue that kids very normally, developmentally appropriate, they start orienting more towards their friends at this time of development. And I think parents feel a little bit, the phrase people often use is, oh, they're pulling away. And I think a lot of parents feel like they have less agency and maybe less influence in their kids' perspectives. So I'd be curious about your thoughts on this and if you can share how parents and caregivers can be what you call in the book or reference in the book as brain builders.
Yes. They act and they need to. I used to think of it as breaking up with us. they need to. Yeah, that can be hard to have someone break up with you. But they need to begin to learn that they can take care of themselves. And so, again, you call it developmentally appropriate. I call it developmentally necessary. Mm. So they need to pull away. That said, every study finds that parents are the prime people in kids' lives. Way, way more important than most of us think. In fact, I found that about a third of parents didn't think they had much influence. But in fact, we do. And it's, you can see it in lots of questions that I ask, like, do you have enough time with your parents or would you like more time with your parents? And very few kids say they have too much time with their parents. Mm. Studies that have done, there's a study that I particularly love. There's a very famous study that shows that if you give kids what's a driving simulation test, in the task is to get to from here to there as fast as possible. But in the in this measure that's called yellow light, the light turns yellow and you have to make a decision about whether you're going to run the light, get there faster, or whether you're going to stop. Then you lose 6 seconds and you'll get there. It'll take longer. But if you could get hit by a car coming in from the side. So you're taking a risk, and it's a study of risk taking. And what this is Larry Steinberg's research has shown is that kids, when their peers are watching them, they're much more likely to take risks.
Mm.
Well, Eva Telsler decided to do the same experiment with parents watching, and she also had a stranger watching. So when the parents were watching, when they were observing the child, and they read from a program, so all the parents said exactly the same thing when the, you know, they were watching from another room with a program script. I'm here, I'm watching you. That it actually took the fun out of it, took the fun out of making dangerous decisions and put the fun into making safe decisions. It was rewarding for kids to make safe decisions. Other studies looked at whether kids change their mind, whether their peers or their parents feel one way or another. And they're more likely, most of them, about two thirds of them stick to what they originally thought. They give them a whole set of scenarios to go through. Also Eva Telsler's from the University of North Carolina's research. But if they change their mind, it's more toward positive things. So other kids aren't necessarily leading our kids astray. And their parents tend to have a big influence. Again, study after study reviewing the impact of a close parent relationship shows that we have a huge influence. As they say, we're watching you. We're learning from you. We want you to support us. And they're figuring out this new relationship just like we are.
Mm, yeah, interesting. And can you explain that concept of brain builders?
It's a phrase that Jackie Bezos at the Bezos Family Foundation used. I love it. She used it about young children. And so thank you, Jackie, for this phrase. But the notion is, and it physically is true, that the experiences that we have, and you know this as a neuroscientist, the experiences we have are building our brains. And one of the places that's really connecting during the adolescent years are the parts that are responsible for executive function kinds of skills, which are the skills that we use to plan, to achieve goals, to bring together our social, emotional, and cognitive capacities. And those are connecting both the emotional parts and the more cognitive parts of our brain. And the research that I just described with Eva Telsler, where it showed that when parents were present, it was rewarding, more rewarding to make safe decisions. Those kinds of experiences are building the brains. Mm-hmm. You can actually see, if you go over time, changes in the brain. Eva's done other studies that look at the quality of parent-child relationships. And if there are good quality of relationships, meaning that the kids trust us, they come to us, they can confide in us, that their brains are, it really grows the brain. Mm,
I love it. I love it. Well, your book is loaded with, I mean, there's a lot to it. And there's science, there's anecdotes, there's strategies. So it really is quite a triumph. So I don't think I said congratulations at the beginning, and I should have.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Nine years.
Yeah, I mean, really. So I would love, if you can even cull something, to hear a favorite strategy or two for how parents can try and work on communication if it's something they've been struggling with. Whether it's, you know, teen reticence or just if they feel like their advice is landing flat or what have you.
I'm going to share two strategies. One is about communication. And the other is about just communication, getting your kids to open up to you. And the other one is about just how you solve problems using communication.
Perfect.
The first is, I used to think of it when my kids were little as hovercrafting. You know, your kids are kind of hovercrafting. They want to talk to you, but they don't quite know how to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
So setting the stage for a conversation is a really good idea. You can often just removed from your regular activities. So if you have the feeling that your child, in this case, it was my son who was at the moment in deep freeze, you know, needed a little thaw before he wanted to talk. Going for a walk, going out to get ice cream, going for a drive, doing something where there's nothing else. You're not on your phones. You're not doing anything else. You're just, you know, walking in the twilight is good because, you know, you have to keep your eyes open because you can't, you don't want to step on anything. But, but you don't see each other. Even the back seat of the car was a great place for conversations. I used to find when the kids were in the back seat of the car and just start with some sort of story and they'll open up, you know. Oh, I just talked to my friend and my friend said this, my friend said that. What advice do you have? You know, just some story that will spark a conversation, conversation prompts. And then the best way to get them to listen is not to be judgmental, not to immediately have an opinion about what they say, repeat back what they say, affirm what they say and validate it. Oh, you know, wow, that must have been scary or that must have been hard or those sorts of things. Or you felt this way. And they'll keep going. Those kinds of lead-ins keep the conversation going. So that is one strategy: finding a time, a place, and being non-judgmental. The second is what I called shared solutions, which is a strategy that I found as a teacher, and it turns out to be very rooted in science, although I wouldn't have known it a long time ago when I was a teacher. Which is because it builds on young children, adolescents' need for some autonomy. Autonomy is something that it's really critical for adolescents because they need to begin to learn to take care of themselves. So they need to have appropriate levels of say. I'm not saying turn over the whole, you know, everything to them. I'm saying as they are able, as they're comfortable in a situation, involve them in decision making. So here's how shared solutions work. So let's say you're having some problem with your kids, some problem with your kid. I just talked to a parent this morning. So here's the problem that she was having. Her son, who's 12, would come in from school, literally throw everything off, litter, you know, the pathway between the door and the couch, sit down on the couch, veg out in front of his computer, didn't do his homework. So and was wanted to stay online and not get off, you know, needed, I need to chill. I need, you know, I need the time. But then by the time it was time to do homework, he was tired. Also, there was all that stuff on the floor and it's his job to pick it up in that family. So what they did was they had a meeting and they shared the issue from the parent's point of view. This is not working for me. This is what happens every day. We do this, you know, and then we get into an argument because you haven't done your homework and it gets worse than it needed to be. But then, so you set the goal. I don't really want to have fighting after school. And then you say, what ideas do you have to solve this problem? And I want as many ideas as possible, and crazy nutty ideas are fine. And then write them down. So you're not being judgmental. You have to withhold the desire to be judgmental. And write down all of the ideas that your child has, and then don't evaluate them. And then you can add some ideas too, if you want to. But it's really important that your child comes up with solutions. It's really, really important because you're teaching them to problem solve. You're teaching them to take on challenges. You're teaching them to do hard things. So you don't want to solve it for your child. You want them to come up with solutions.
Yes.
Then you go through step three. You ask what would work about this solution from your point of view and what would work about this solution from my point of view. Well, it may work from your point of view, but all the stuff on the floor may not work from my point of view. You know, so you say that would work for you, but this wouldn't work for me. And that's why. So let's keep going till you come up with a solution that would presumably be the best at working for both of you. And then you say, then you have a change experiment. You say, we're going to try this. And see how it goes. And we're going to evaluate, you can say, in a week or 5 days or at the end of this week or however long you want it to be. We're not gonna say it's not working right away. We're gonna really look at it over a couple of days. Well, this child, mother told me about this morning, decided to come into a different door after school, just coming into a different door. And he came into the door where he's supposed to put his coat down and his backpack down and his, you know, all his stuff down. So it was easier for him to come in and put that stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
And then his choice was maybe 30, 45 minutes. He either had a choice of 30 or 45 minutes online, and he seems to be able to get offline. Some kids have more trouble with that, so that might not be the choice that you want. But and then he'll do his homework, or he does his homework right away. And for the first couple of days, he's been doing his homework right away and getting it over with so he can really enjoy the time on playing games.
Yeah, so, that's great.
Yeah. So it's prompting a conversation, but it's prompting a problem-solving conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. I love that. Okay, Ellen, we're going to cut to another quick break, and then we're going to be back to talk about achievement culture.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests, too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, friends. We're back with the wonderful Ellen Galinsky. Ellen, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about achievement culture. I'm a parent of a 12-year-old and a 19-year-old, and having gone through the college application process, I just feel like it's worse than ever, and it's disheartening for the pressure system that I feel around achievement. I would love to hear your perspective about winding back on achievement culture, and especially how parents can reorient to support their kids on the process, not the product.
Oh, great, great question. Well, first of all, kids, this is research that Rick Riceborg did at Harvard. Kids think that the achievement culture matters to us. They think that their performance matters more than we think it does. So when in his study, when parents were asked what was most important for kids, it was things like caring and, you know, being kind and other stuff. When that's what parents thought they were communicating, but their children didn't feel that way. They thought they were communicating, you know, you better do well because I want you to be able to go to this high school or go to this college or have the job that you want or whatever it is. And it's because, again, we're afraid, just like because we're negative about kids, we're afraid for them. You know, it's our protective instinct. It's not that we're bad. We're just wanting to make sure that they have the best possible life. So we have to watch how much, you know, what we praise in our children. Do we praise? We're always saying, you know, how'd you do on that test? And did you get an A? And what did your teacher think of it? Versus, you know, tell me about a time when you solved a problem in your class for another friend or helped a friend, or, you know, we're valuing caring or connections or something else. So that's one thing that I would say is to watch ourselves, but it's all around us. There's wonderful research that Wendy Grolnick from Clark University did, where she asked parents to do homework with kids. And in one scenario, she asked parents to do homework where the child would be graded and they would be judged. In another scenario, they asked to do homework, but it didn't matter. And of course, you know, the parents who felt that their child was going to be judged and they were going to be judged got kind of mean about it and took over a lot. And yeah, I know. We can't help ourselves because we want the best for our kids. And so it's all around us. And we're just going to have to really be conscious of saying what matters in our family, what's most important, what are our family values. Mm. And I know between my two kids going to college, although it's nothing like the pressure cooker, you know, it's not that long ago, but it's nothing like the pressure cooker that it is today. With my son, I was much more anxious about it than with my daughter. With my daughter, I figured if she didn't like it, she'd transfer. You know, it wasn't going to be the end of the world, because my son didn't like his first choice and did transfer, and it worked out wonderfully for him. So it's just like, it's not the end of the world. You know, you're not being judged forever in your life. Things, you know, and then really involve them in the choice. I know that for colleges, my daughter made a list of what she was going to value in education and how she would know it was there. And we took friends to go visit, but she then looked for the things that were important. And at the end of the visit, she would tell us what she or what her friends saw that fit her values. And her values were more about how people treated each other and whether people contributed and whether they, in this particular schools that she was looking for, she was looking for opportunities to make the world a better place. So, but I don't think we would have gotten there if we hadn't gone through that exercise.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It's like the values report. That is so cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
Made it less pressured for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, just that process wasn't so long ago for us. My daughter's a sophomore now, and it really is so wonderful to see them find their thing and see them thrive when they make those choices on their own. She had a very specific kind of values-based way she was approaching where she applied, and it was really wonderful to see that pay off. So I'm glad you experienced that as well.
I think it's part of the readiness culture. We've been sold on the notion of readiness, getting kids ready for school, getting kids ready, for life, getting, you know, all of those sorts of things. It's just part of the way education and caring about children have been sold. So although getting ready is important, a lot of kids told me, let us be our age. Let us be who we are. Let us enjoy now. Mm-hmm. You know, you all, you grownups, you know, you have to learn to live in the present. Let us live in the present.
Wow. Out of the mouth of babes. That's a really good one.
Yeah, I thought so.
All right, Ellen. Well, I know I need to let you go, and I just have one final quick question. So at the end of every show, I ask my guest to share what is called your next edit. So this is just a really super actionable tip that listeners can consider doing right away after they finish listening to this conversation. So I would love to hear, in the context of what we've been talking about, what your next edit is for this episode.
You have such good questions. I love that. I love that. What a good question. Well, I think that it was something that I discovered when I was, again, research is so exciting. I asked parents about a time when they lost it with their child, when they weren't the parent that they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And then I had them walk me through it, you know, like, your child said this, you felt this, you said this, your child responded. How did you feel? What did you think? What did you say? You know, just going, sort of taking a trip in their minds with them, reliving an experience. And I discovered there were three things that were going on with people who were not the parent that they wanted to be. The first was they felt that things couldn't change. That would be Carol Dweck's kind of fixed mindset notion, that this is the way it is. This is the way it's going to be in the future. The second was they saw it as a threat, not as a challenge. So when you see something as a threat, and again, you know, this is a neuroscientist, it activates different parts of your brain than when you see it as a challenge. When you see it as a challenge, Dan Siegel, I love this, calls it a yes brain versus a no brain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If it's a threat, it's a no brain. You know, you're on, you know, fight or flight. But if it's a challenge, you see it as an opportunity to learn. You can figure it out. And the third part would be, I think that I have the capacity to solve this. I don't know how I'm going to do it right now, but I think I have the capacity. I would ask parents when they're stuck to think about a possibility mindset, which is, are you thinking that things can or can't change? Are you seeing this as a threat, or are you seeing it as a challenge? And then do you think that you can figure it out or not? And then if you shift your mindset so that you can see it as something that you can solve, then I bet you're going to be much more likely to solve it.
Ooh, I like this. That is fantastic. Ellen, I am just so grateful to have this time on the mic with you. Thank you for this beautiful conversation and for all the gifts that your book is sure to deliver to parents. It's a triumph, and I'm really grateful just to have the opportunity to talk to you today. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm such an admirer. Such a joy to be with you.
The feeling is mutual. Take care.
You too.
Friends, wasn't that wonderful? You'll find the show notes for this episode, including links to resources and related episodes, at edityourlifeshow.com. As ever, I would love to hear your thoughts and questions. Come say hello on Instagram or Facebook at edityourlifeshow, or send an email to edityourlifeshow@gmail.com. I would also be grateful if you would drop Edit Your Life a review on Apple Podcasts or tell a pod-loving friend about the show. Thanks for listening.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.